You're listening to the Table Talk podcast, brought to you by Food Matters Live.
Welcome to the Table Talk podcast. I'm Stephen Gates. I'm a TV presenter and a writer specialising in food and science. Now, this podcast is all about gut health and what we can do to maximise it. And it's brought to you by the lovely wellbeing team at Kellogg's. And we have the fantastic Professor Glenn Gibson. He's Professor of Food Microbiology at Reading University. Hello.
Hi, Steph.
And we've got Laura Tilt, a registered dietitian.
Hello.
Hello. Now, let's just start off by sort of laying down the groundwork here. What do we mean by good gut health? Maybe Laura, do you want to start with this one?
Oh, thank you. I'll jump in. You might. It's interesting because there's actually no definition of what good gut health is, which is surprising since we hear there's so much chat about gut health now. But there's probably a few characteristics that we can think about when we're talking about gut health. So first of all, a healthy gut is able to do its job properly, which means digesting and absorbing all the nutrients in the food we eat effectively. Good gut health means having regular poos, you know, opening your bowels regularly and without pain. I'd say it also means that we are relatively free from symptoms like bloating and constipation, although, you know, we occasionally all can experience things like heartburn. These symptoms shouldn't be sort of occurring on a regular sort of daily basis. And something else we hear about a lot is the microbiome, so the collection of microbes that live in our gut and the genes that they control. We're learning that it's really important to have a robust and diverse microbiome, which helps us have a good immune function, helps with a good immune function as well.
Now, Glenn,
yeah.
You have a variety of gut microbiomes in your lab. I visited your lab quite a few years ago now, but it's possibly the smelliest place I've ever been in my life. Now, you do a huge amount of research into the gut. Now, I think only over the last couple of years have we realised that this is a massive area.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, research is piling into this and discovering just more and more all the time. Can you tell us a little bit about your work and about what from the research that's unfolding, yours and other people's, what are we beginning to discover about gut health and its effect on all the different elements of being human?
Sure. So when you visited, Steph, you saw our gut models. And so these are glass systems, pots, vessels, pumps, filters, tubes and things which reflect a real person's gut. And as you said, it's probably the smelliest, certainly the smelliest lab in Reading, if not the south
clean,
of England.
Don't get me wrong,
really. You still owe me that clothes peg I lent you as well. And so we test interventions in these models, and we know that they get close to the real gut. So if we're interested in infants, for instance, or children, adults, elderly, certain clinical states like IBS, autism, obesity, colitis, whatever we're really interested in, we can set up a gut model of that. And then we test the microbiome in those gut models, how they respond to diet, which we put into them, and maybe supplements like probiotics, prebiotics, etc., which we feel help improve the health of the gut. And then we use that information to do human studies. So we jump from the model systems into human intervention trials, because I always feel that kind of the definitive outcome of the research is really testing in vivo in humans themselves. So we don't do any animal work because of ethical as well as biological reasons, because we feel we can get closer to a real person's gut with our models than we can with any lab animal, really.
And the interesting thing really is the fact that you have to have all of these different models, because there's a huge diversity in what different people's gut biome consists of. And
yeah.
In what way can they be different?
Well, they can differ depending on our age. So when we are born, we pick up our gut bugs during birth, essentially. It's not a nice thing to think of, but it largely come from mum's vaginal or fecal flora. So the first ever present we get is during birth, and it comes from our dear old mum, and she knew nothing about it whatsoever. But it was a very valuable present, and it was the present of bacteria, and so they go in there and they find a very warm, nutritious environment for themselves. And you know, bearing in mind bacteria can grow virtually anywhere, volcanoes are not a problem, bottom of the ocean bed, the human guts are really really, really easy area for them to get up to very high numbers indeed. And then depending on the type of feeding in early days, whether we're bottle or breastfed, differences then begin to develop. Breastfed alleged, or well, it's not alleged, it's a fact, have a far healthier microbiome than formula-fed counterparts. Then when we move from milk onto weaning foods, the semi-solid foods is another change. And then again, when we go on to an adult diet, there are further changes. And really, diet does drive the microbiome content, but also other factors like stress, age, exercise can also have a contributing factor as well. But diet is really the one.
So, Laura, is there one type of healthy gut, or are there multiple versions of what we... You know, is there a profile of a gut that we should all be striving for?
Yeah, I guess when we're just talking about the microbiome, the answer is no. I don't think there's any agreement on what is a universally healthy microbiome. There's probably lots of different healthy ones, and they don't necessarily have, you know, that much in common. I think what is agreed is having a diverse microbiome is a good thing. And that's because having a range of bacteria means that, you know, they can carry out different jobs for us as well. And we do see in certain conditions that there is a narrowing of diversity. So, for example, we see in patients with IBS, quite often they have lower levels of some of the important or beneficial microbes in their gut. But what's not clear is whether that is a cause or consequence of the condition. So we're still learning. But I think what is agreed is that having a diverse microbiome is important.
Because, we're only really scratching the surface of understanding this at the moment. So, yeah. Do you think that at some stage, Glenn, that there will be, we'll literally be able to write up the profile of what's in there and which bits you need, or the balance of one particular bacteria of another that constitutes a healthy variety?
I think we're at the stage where we know there are positive, negative and neutral bacteria in everyone's gut, and fluctuations are going to occur depending on who that is and the type of diet that we have. But we can pinpoint which ones are positive for health, which is really good news, because it means we can then target those through our diet or through other interventions to try and boost their numbers and help reduce the risk of disease, or maybe even manage certain diseases. So I think it's a very exciting area. People do say it's very complicated. That's because there's a lot of them.
And whenever there's a lot... professors of microbiology, like you are.
Oh, dear, we've all had it. So when there's a lot of things, people think, But if you break it down, there are families of bacteria in the gut, and within those families there are groups, and within those groups there are species, and within those species there are strains. And the further you go down that level, the more and more of them are. So our research tends to be actually at the higher end of that, at the group level. And generally, people living in this country and in this room now will have more or less the same groups of bacteria. And that's where I feel functionally we can make a difference, by targeting the groups that we know are positive for health at the expense of the ones which are less so. And it's sort of not that difficult to do, to alter a person's microbiome. The real key is, what does that mean for the person's health? How can we prove that it has a health effect, and what the mechanism is?
Yeah. Okay. So, Laura, how do we do this? What are the tools at our disposal to improve our gut health?
Yeah. Well, as Glenn said, excitingly, we have a degree of control over one of the most important factors, which is diet. Obviously, we all eat three times a day, maybe more, much more sometimes for some of us. And just like we need meals, so do our microbes. But there are some that they kind of thrive or do better on. And one of the sort of most important nutrients to them is fibre. So fibre is a type of carbohydrate that doesn't get digested and absorbed in the upper GI tract like other carbohydrates. So it travels through the gut sort of relatively undigested and lands in our large intestine or our colon, where most of our microbes live. And it gives them energy, they ferment it, and they consume fibre, and they produce various kind of compounds as a result, which have various positive effects in the body. So these compounds are known as short-chain fatty acids. So they feed the microbes in our gut, but also probably the thing that most of us associate fibre with is helping us to poo, you know, keeping us regular. Fibre helps you sort of speed the movement of waste through the gut, and also sort of helps to bulk out our poo, making it easier for us to poop. So there's a number of benefits.
You love that poo.
I think we are. I think we're becoming more comfortable talking about poo, which is really important. It's, you know, our microbiome is invisible to the naked eye. You know, we can't pop a mirror up against our bellies and see what's happening in our guts. And obviously, you know, sequencing and testing the microbiome is something that's becoming more widely available, but, you know, mostly helpful in research. We were talking about this before, mostly helpful in research studies rather than on a sort of population individual level at the moment. And so, you know, how do we know whether our guts are functioning well? You know, one of the indicators that we have is kind of being aware of our poo habits. So how often we're going to the loo, you know, whether we're getting any symptoms as well.
And being able to chart your poo on the Bristol stool.
Yeah, I mean, I've travelled from Bristol today. Yeah, the Bristol stool chart, if you haven't heard of that, developed, I think it was in the 1997 it came out, and still in use as, yes, it's a cartoon images of poop. And actually
for identification purposes,
And it's actually really helpful because you know, when somebody sat in front of you talking about their poo habits, it can be quite embarrassing. Sometimes people feel quite inhibited about, you know, talking about what happens when they go into the bathroom, and so actually being able to, you know, point to a type of poop on a chart is helpful.
So and that's almost a sort of a mechanical side of it, but it goes much further than this, doesn't it? I mean, our gut biome, it seems as though this also impacts our mental health at some level as well. Can you explain a bit more about that?
Yeah, so we've known that our, you know, the gut and the brain are connected for a long time. So they're like physically connected. You've got a nerve that runs from your brain right into your gut. It's called the vagus nerve, which I think comes from the word, a Greek word, which means wandering, and it does wander right the way down.
It's nothing to do with Las Vegas. Using large amounts of money. Katy Perry.
Wanders down from your brain right into the depths of your gut. And so that means that, you know, lots of people talk about things like gut feeling and having butterflies when we're nervous. And essentially, you know, when you feel anxious or stressed, your gut feels it too. That's because certain sort of chemical messengers which are released when we feel stressed or anxious can travel down to our gut and affect our gut function, which is why you might sort of find yourself running to the toilet when you have an interview. And, you know, we all experience kind of nervous tummy when we have exams. You know, we also know that, so we've known about that communication for a long time. But we've also learnt that our microbes are also capable of producing various chemical neurotransmitters, which can actually talk to our brains. So there's like a two-way communication going on. And certain types of microbes, therefore, may be able to influence our mood and our mental well-being. And potentially then we can affect that through the foods that we eat.
Is it called gut quorum sensing or something like that?
So quorum sensing is bacteria kind of talking to one another. So they send messages to each other, and there was some amazing work years ago actually, which in the gut, in the cells of the guts often secrete mucin, which is mucus, you know, that sort of thing. And bacteria feed off that, and there was some amazing work that showed that bacteria could send little signals like quorum sensing signals to tell the cells of the gut to secrete mucin when they were hungry, effectively, and chop it up,
it
and then send another one to stop it.
Secret world,
yeah,
in there,
incredible,
isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, not only are they living in us as the ultimate hotels, they're actually controlling us as well.
And they're chatting to each other. They're chatting to each other. It's outrageous. Okay, so Glenn, can you? You've done lots of work in prebiotics and probiotics. Now, for anyone who's had their head under a rock, what is the difference between prebiotics and probiotics, and what do they do?
Okay, so probiotics are live bacteria in the diet. So these are the beneficial microbes that they usually call lactobacilli bifidobacteria, the commonest ones. So those are the use in food vehicles. Yogurts are popular, little fermented milk drinks, juices, things like this. You also get them dried in capsules or tablets, sprays even. And prebiotic is trying to achieve the same thing, i.e. boosting the positive bacteria or bugs in the gut. But a prebiotic is more like the fertilizer. So that's a growth source for the ones that are downstairs already. So, you know, if you've got a garden with roses and weeds in it, you want more roses, less weeds. A probiotic would be like planting roses, and a prebiotic would be like a fertilizer for the roses that kills the weeds.
That's a lovely analogy, yeah. That's coming with me today.
And so those are the differences. And prebiotics are what we do most of our research on, because we feel that they're more stable. You can put them in lots of foods, certain supplements, and the levels of change that you get in the gut is pretty impressive, actually, if you get it right.
And when we're talking about prebiotics, you're talking about sort of feeding what's already there. What sort of substances are we talking about? Are these supplements, or are they naturally available in foods?
Both, Stefan. So they can be synthesised, but or the existing foods already. So, for instance, onion, garlic.
When you say synthesised, you mean we can synthesise?
No. They're deliberately manufactured, like you know, you would manufacture a pharmaceutical or something like that. So the foods that have good prebiotic content are cereals, onion, garlic, asparagus, banana, artichoke, chicory root. But the kind of prebiotics which are most recognised are called FOS. Or GOS, fructooligosaccharides, or galactooligosaccharide, and FOS is also called inulin, not insulin, inulin. So those are very good. Both FOS and GOS are very good prebiotics.
Lots proven of that in Jerusalem artichokes.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, and I got agave as well. So the people who like tequila might... Anyway, yeah. So, yeah.
This is so wishful thinking.
Yeah.
We know what's going on here.
So those are good. And FOS and GOS have been shown in lots of different labs reproducibly to have a very good prebiotic effect in that they really boost these beneficial microbes.
Yeah. And is there an advantage in having stuff that is naturally in the diet compared to a supplement?
I think both. You know, the types of foods that you find them in naturally, it might be tricky to get enough of those because you need about 5 grams or something of a prebiotic to have a good effect. But cereals are a rich source. Bran is included in that. Starch-type cereals, oat-type cereals as well. And then the supplements are either used as individual ingredients themselves, or lots of companies are now taking those ingredients and putting them in other foods at which they aren't at particularly high levels. For instance, maybe bread is an example, baked other baked products, drinks, and so on. So, I mean, the things to look for is either the name prebiotic, but that's actually quite rare because it's not very often used. But the ingredients and FOS and GOS are good examples.
So, okay, so Laura, you need to sort of talk to people about improving their gut health and eating more of these products. How do you do it without either lecturing them or sounding like you're getting them to eat food that they don't really want to eat? What's the trick?
I mean, I think, first of all, people are quite switched on to the idea that gut health's important now, so it makes it an easier, you know, it's an easy job already because there's been, you know, so much emerging research and, you know, we can be really confident that good gut health is important for our overall well-being, but potentially our risk of other conditions that we, you know, as we age. So the cells, you know, we're sold on it, so it already makes it easier. I think we always need to start from where people are, so it's really easy for, you know, us to feel like we're lecturing people sometimes. We should be doing this and we should be doing that. And also I think government sort of guidelines or nutrition guidelines aren't always that helpful. So, for example, we're advised to eat 30 grams of fibre, which doesn't really mean much to anybody except the nutrition professionals that are talking about it. So I think we need to make it really practical for people. So I guess there's a piece to be done around... I always think if people understand why we're asking them to do something, it's always easier to encourage them to do so. So kind of explaining about the role of fibre, you know, why we're asking people to do it. And we've got strong evidence that, you know, fibre, you know, we know that it feeds microbes in the gut and we know that good things happen when the microbes consume the fibre. And actually when people understand that, and then also we've seen that, you know, lower fibre diets actually reduce the numbers of beneficial microbes in the gut is quite a big sell then, because you can make a correlation between what you're eating and kind of what's happening in your gut. And then, yeah, it's really practical stuff. So I always sort of chat to people about thinking about where they are now. So maybe jotting down what they're eating in a typical day and then going through from breakfast and thinking about where they can practically make changes. So we talked about, you know, you talked about breakfast cereal. So maybe the first thing people do is, you know, flip to the back of the nutrition panel on the back of a cereal and kind of compare how much fibre's in what they're eating now to maybe other kind of brands on the shelf. And then, you know, maybe once they've done breakfast, thinking about what's the next meal they eat, could they add some more fruits and veggies to that, could they switch from maybe a white bread to a whole wheat bread, switch from white pasta to whole wheat, that type of thing.
That's an interesting one, because that concept has been around for quite a long time, and I wondered how much more fibre do you actually get from a slice of wholemeal bread compared to white bread? Is it significant enough to really make a difference?
I think it's when it's over the period of a day. If we do a number of small changes add up, that's the thing. So one, you know, one for one, maybe you're going to get, maybe if there's a gram of fibre in white bread, you might find that in wholemeal bread, if it's thick sliced, maybe, you know, more towards three. So a small difference on that individual item, but it's over a whole day that it adds up. So we're advised to eat about 30 grams of fibre in the UK, and this recommendation came out in 2015, and following the recommendation, the British Nutrition Foundation did some modelling around what we would need to do to get that 30 grams and also not consume more than 5% of our calories as sugar, and make sure we kind of fitted around all the other recommendations. And they found that we would need to eat between 5 and 8 servings of fruits and veg a day. Two or three of our main meals would need to contain starchy whole grains, so something like wholemeal bread or whole wheat pasta. And we would need to be snacking on fruits, nuts, seeds, and including sort of pulses in our diet regularly, which it's not really reflective of where most of us are at the moment.
Yeah. What about kids who really could not give less of a care for nutrition? I spend a lot of time talking to kids, and the moment you mention things like nutrition and fibre, even the word calories, they roll their eyes and they wish you were dead and they would and that you'd go away. So how do we change things for them when you can't really tell them about the nuts and bolts of it necessarily? Well, unless you can make it interesting. What are the tools at your disposal?
So I think making it interesting, maybe I saw a piece of work, it was called Microbe Motels. Like, it was a sort of project they did in school about teaching children that there's these microbes that live in your gut, and actually you need to provide them with meals and the kind of foods that they enjoy. And, you know, so that could be one way, and selling it maybe to younger children. I think maybe when they get into teenage years, they're maybe less engaged in that type of information. Stealth maybe as well. Sometimes,
yeah,
it's always
light and solid.
And, you know, it's not always, you know, we don't always have to make huge changes. So it might be, you know, if your children don't like porridge and the idea of eating it sort of, you know, makes them make rude faces at you, then maybe you just start off with switching up like a breakfast cereal, or maybe you just put out, you know, a selection of like fruits and nuts and kind of try to make it a bit more interesting for them. And yeah, sneaking veggies into sauces, and, you know, potentially using, Glenn talked about the fact that we have, you know, prebiotics are naturally occurring in foods, which is great. And but there are also certain foods now we're seeing, breakfast cereals with kind of added prebiotics as well. So potentially that's another way to.
So the added bit is really interesting. So Glenn, if you go into health food shops now, you can often buy packs of fibre. And, you know, I've seen inulin for sale as well. And you could just eat it. I mean, it sounds like a horrible way to go about your life. But is it viable? Do you just buy a pack of fibre and chuck a couple of spoons?
I think for prebiotics, yes, because you can. Indeed, you can get the Fos and Gos as supplements and take them however you want. Just as supplement, and conveniently, some of them even give you a sachet with the recommended daily dose of them, which is quite nice. You can do what you like. You can stick it on your cereal or in your drinks, or just take it as a supplement themselves. And they don't particularly test of anything. They're very slightly sweet. But the good thing is you don't get the calorie exchange that you do with sugar, because they're not absorbed. They're broken down by the bacteria. The human body doesn't really deal with them. And so they go straight down into the end of the GI tract, into the large intestine, where the bugs are just sitting waiting to be stimulated. And that's indeed what happens. And so there's very much reduced calorie exchange. And as Laura said, the products which are then produced via the bugs then can have beneficial effects within the gut and outside the gut.
And are you firm of stool?
Am I of what?
Are you firm of stool?
Have you got the Bristol stool scale, and I'll have a quick look?
Okay, we're going to stop it right there. You will be relieved to learn that that's the end of part one of this podcast. But do join us for part two, when we'll be getting deeper into your gut and looking at new research, the possibility of personalization that gut microbe profiling might offer, and a little bit of future gazing. This podcast has been brought to you by the lovely well-being team at Kellogg's. Goodbye for now.
Thank you for listening to the Table Talk podcast. If you've enjoyed it, please share a review. If you like what you've heard, find out more on foodmatterslive.com or find us on Twitter and Facebook.